Number two, when Israel was proclaimed a separate nation in 1947 by the United Nations, the United States was the first great power to give it diplomatic recognition. Ever since that time, there has been a special relationship between the governments of the two countries. An essential ingredient in maintaining this relationship has been domestic support within the United States. For more than three decades, American public opinion has been generally pro-Israel. But the Andrew Young affair is causing Israel to be seen in a different light by many Americans. For one thing, questions are now being raised about Israeli intelligence activity in the United States. In the past, this has never been a public issue. But that is changing because of the way in which the Young affair broke wide open. On August 16, the day after he resigned, Young held a news conference at the United Nations. In the words of the BBC that evening, Young blamed Israel for the events which led to his resignation. That same day, the Atlanta Constitution reported that Israeli intelligence agents had spied on Young's meeting with PLO Representative Terazi. The newspaper said that this enabled Israel to challenge Young's original statement that the meeting had been inadvertent. Israel's United Nations Ambassador Bloom immediately denied the report, but when Young was asked about it, he said that he assumed he was being bugged, but he did not care. Since then, reports have continued to multiply about Israeli spying in the Young episode. Israeli denials have just led to increasingly detailed reports about the spying. And in the process, broader questions are being asked about Israeli spying here in the United States. All this is very worrisome to the government of Israel because they have, my friends, left a trail. The fact is that the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency, is very active in the United States. But this is in violation of a secret agreement under which the Mossad is forbidden from this activity. In return, our own CIA is forbidden from the clandestine activities in Israel. Strangely enough, I can report that the CIA has adhered to the agreement, but both did work together in the Jonestown Guyana tragedy, as I revealed in Audio Letter 40. Israel is fearful of having Mossad activities here exposed as a cause célèbre. Technically, the hundreds of Mossad agents in the United States could be rounded up and expelled. If this was done with great fanfare, the impact on Israel's image here in America could be devastating. World opinion would also veer away from Israel. So the Zionists are doing everything in their power not to have an investigation. What they want most is for the controversy to just go away. At the same time, they're trying to put the best possible face on Israeli intelligence. For example, on August 21, an article appeared in the Washington Star entitled, "Discreet Mossad Called World's Best." The article is built mainly around the statements not by Israelis, but by former American intelligence officials. The impression conveyed is that the mighty Mossad easily could spy on anyone it wants to, but we are also to believe they just wouldn't do such a thing as spy on the Young Terazi meeting. So far, though, the questions about Israeli spying in the Young affair are refusing to go away. On August 23, the Washington Star carried a story in which an unnamed United States source is quoted as saying, "The Israelis have staked out the Arabs around the United Nations with bugs, taps, and surveillances. Young walked right into it," unquote. The article says considerably more about the Young episode. Then it expands into the subject of Israeli spying here in general. For example, quote, "According to one source, New York City is the center of Israeli spying in the United States and has been for years." Another quote, "On one occasion, United States officials learned that an Israeli wiretap operation was using a local synagogue as a cover." And a final quote, "Each year in New York, moreover, there are numerous cases in which Israeli agents have been identified posing as FBI agents, complete with seemingly authentic credentials, unquote. By any standards, my friends, words like these in a major American newspaper signal a change from the past. Controversy over intelligence activities could become a major fallout against Israel from the Young affair. But there is another domestic fallout which is even more important, and that is the rupturing of political and other ties between the blacks and the Jews. These tensions are very real, my friends, and have been building since the mid-60s. But they have only now burst into the open for all to see. The catalyst, of course, was the Young affair. Up until now, practically the only Americans who were aware of these tensions were the blacks and Jews themselves. But the strongest feelings in this rift are felt by the blacks. They are the ones who feel they have been wronged. So I think the easiest way to describe the situation is in the words of blacks themselves. On August 16, Young himself blamed Israel for making his resignation necessary. The same day, it was disclosed that United States Ambassador to Austria, Milton Wolf, had met three times with PLO representatives. But Wolf, who is Jewish, was not being reprimanded, much less forced to resign. For blacks, that news added insult to injury. It got still worse the next day, August 17. It was announced that the United States had made a surprise proposal regarding a Security Council resolution on Palestinian rights. The United States had asked Israel to support an American-sponsored resolution to that effect, but without success. With that news, Andy Young looked like nothing more than the fall guy for a new American policy. Blacks wondered, why Andy? Why a black? The same day, Young made comments on the NBC Today show, which were repeated on the BBC World Service. Young was asked about latent anti-Semitism in the black community and said, quote, I think there may be a resentment of a certain kind of arrogance that was played up, especially in the New York press. And there was a kind of arrogance of Jewish power, headlines saying Jews demand Young's ouster. I think that's caused a reaction by the black community, which is a natural reaction. But in no way does that constitute anti-Semitism, unquote. The following day, August 18, an article in the New York Daily News illustrated the growing reaction of black America. The article was by black columnist Earl Caldwell. It was titled, Finally Played the Game and Lost. Referring to the day after Young's resignation, Caldwell wrote, quote, On Thursday, the afternoon was filled with a fallout. The clamor for his resignation had come primarily from the Jewish community. That is fact. And now, the backlash that Andrew Young had warned the Israeli ambassador about was rising. Downstairs on the steps of the mission, the Reverend Jesse Jackson was saying that Andrew Young was the fall guy, and that it was not the Klan that brought the Bakke case, that it was not the Klan that deals with Southern Africa, and that it was not the Klan that brought the pressure to fire Andrew Young. It was our former allies. And the backlash was building, end of quote from the Earl Caldwell column. The rift between blacks and Jews is continuing to grow, my friends. Already a group of black ministers of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference has held a meeting with Palestinians, and they have announced their support for Palestinian rights. And during the past several days, a series of very powerful commentaries about the situation were carried over the American Forces radio and television service. The commentator was James Rowe of the Mutual Black Network. Unlike most other programs on the American Forces radio, the Rowe commentaries are followed by a disclaimer originating with the Mutual Black Network, but they are being beamed straight to our troops here and overseas. And of course, our armed forces of today have a very high proportion of blacks here and abroad. The Rowe commentaries on the Young affair are instructive for two reasons. For one thing, they illustrate the growing backlash by many blacks against Israel. But also, Roe reminds his listeners of some historical background facts which must be taken into account. Most Americans, black or otherwise, do not remember this background, or at least do not think about it. In his commentary 4 days ago, August 23, Roe began, quote, "It's time the United States stopped placating the Israelis and got down to the serious business of negotiating peace in the Middle East." Every time something offends Israel, the Jewish American population rises up. They expect black Americans to support them, despite the refusal of Jewish groups to support some of our most recent concerns. The Jewish groups left us when it came to reverse discrimination. Despite that, what is more important is right and wrong. It is wrong that we support an ethnic group when they are mistaken, and Israel is mistaken in the treatment of the Palestinians. We cannot continue to pay for Hitler's mistakes. Israel cannot be permitted to perpetrate upon another group of people what the Germans tried to do to them in World War II. If Israel has a right to exist, then so does the state of Palestine. The goal now should be, how do we achieve that? Unquote. Further on, Roe said, "The United States ambassador to Austria was not asked to resign, although he had several meetings with the PLO representatives. So why did Andrew Young have to resign? Why did the first black United States ambassador have to become the fall guy in a plan to appease Jerusalem and the Jewish lobby here? It is extremely complicated and much greater than concerns for oil from the region." Unquote. The next day, August 24, James Roe had more to say about the Young resignation, and he included some history in very concise terms. Here's an excerpt from his commentary, quote, "We cannot let ourselves go on the defensive every time the Jewish American lobby criticizes blacks as anti-Semitic because we don't agree with them. Anybody that doesn't agree with Israel's hardline stand is considered anti-Semitic in Jerusalem. If anyone is to be charged with responsibility for the current crisis in the Middle East, it should be Great Britain. And if anyone is to be charged with the protracted conflict in that region of the world, it is to be Israel. Britain had control over the land that made up Jordan and Palestine under a League of Nations mandate. The British wanted to end their colonialism there and permitted Zionists to move in uncontrolled and left the Palestinians to the Jordanians. The Palestinians were left without a home because London did not follow through on the United Nations recommendation of creating two separate states, one for the Israelis and one for the Palestinians. It appears Israel wants the Palestinians completely removed from the scene. Now comes the Andrew Young card. How does the United States support the human rights of the Palestinians without offending our long-time and hard-line friends in the Zionist movement? The United States is faced with supporting the human rights of the Palestinians, but to the offense of Jews." Perhaps Andy Young was the test of how offended Israel would be if America decided to give in to demands from the Palestine Liberation Organization. End of quotation from the Roe Commentary of August 24. My friends, there was nothing accidental about the Young affair. To those who do not know about Russia's secret takeover here in Washington, it all looks like a big mistake. But in reality, Israel's mighty Mossad has just been outfoxed by Russia's KGB. The Russians, through the robotoids in the White House, control most all the top positions in the United States government. They brought about the Young Terazi meeting of July 26, and in doing so, they knew it would be monitored by Israeli intelligence. The Russians succeeded in planning and guiding events in a way beneficial to Russia. In Audio Letter 46, I mentioned that Prime Minister Begin of Israel had been replaced with a robotoid, as had Sadat of Egypt. Wholesale robotizing is not taking place in those countries. By using their Begin robotoid, Russia was able to make sure that Israel's policy would be to make an issue of Young's PLO contact. This action has caused the backlash reactions against Israel, which I have already discussed. It has also enhanced the image of the Palestinians internationally. In addition, the Young Flap provides an excuse for the United States to back into a more favorable treatment of the Palestinian cause. But, my friends, there will be other manipulated events to distract you from the Andrew Young affair, all created by friends of Israel still in our United States State Department. The Russian target in the Andrew Young affair appears at first glance to be all the Jews in both Israel and the United States, but that is not the case. The true target in these Kremlin maneuvers is the political force called Zionism. Many Jews are not Zionists, and there are also Zionists who are not Jews. But Zionism masquerades as a movement that speaks for all Jews. For reasons I will discuss in Topic 3, the Christ ones who rule Russia today intend to utterly break Zionism as a force in the world. A major part of this is to be the dismantling of Zionist power here in America. To that end, the Andrew Young affair was engineered to uncork the political pressures between Jews and blacks. On the surface, this appears to mean all Jews. But the commentaries I quoted by James Rowe suggest that already the focus is narrowing. Black leaders are looking around carefully, and as they look at the Zionists, they are doing so with frowns and narrowed eyes. Topic number 3. It has now been nearly 2 years since I first made public the overthrow of the Bolsheviks in Russia. And as my older listeners know, this is the outcome of 6 decades of struggle by a tightly knit band of native Russian Christians. Now they are out to destroy Bolshevism worldwide. The Kremlin's campaign to wipe out Bolshevism is still a secret officially, but as important as Bolshevism is, the Kremlin rulers regard it as just one major tentacle of a giant serpent. And if they keep their anti-Bolshevism secret, they make no bones about their opposition to what they see as another tentacle. That tentacle is Zionism. The origins of modern-day Zionism trace back to the late 19th century, but the first major milestone toward the creation of a Jewish state happened in 1917. Great Britain was looking for all the friends she could find in what was then called the Great War. That year, the United States was drawn into that war with the deliberate help of President Woodrow Wilson. But that same year, Russia was removed from the war against Germany by the Bolshevik Revolution. So the Allies were still under great pressure. And in order to enlist the growing power of the Zionist movement on the side of Britain, the famous Balfour Declaration was announced. Lord Balfour announced that Britain would look with favor on their creation of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Most Americans were too preoccupied with news of the war to think long about the Balfour Declaration in Britain, but soon after the war ended, a major protest was published against the plans of the Zionists. On March 5, 1919, readers of the New York Times saw a long petition on page 7 with the headline, "Protest to President Wilson Against Zionist State." Nowadays, if we saw a headline like that, most of us would probably pay little attention. We would assume that it was the work of the Arabs and turn the page. But that 1919 protest was presented and signed exclusively by Jews. And these were not some small splinter group of malcontents. They were a galaxy of Jewish stars in American politics, education, law, business, medicine, journalism, banking, as well as prominent rabbis. People like Congressman Julius Kahn of California, who headed the list, Henry Morgenthau, Sr., ex-ambassador to Turkey, Simon Wolf, former consul to Egypt, Max Sr., former president of the National Conference of Jewish Charities, Professor Morris Jastrow of the University of Pennsylvania, Adolph Ox, publisher of the New York Times, Lessing Rosenthal, Chicago attorney, Dr. Julius Rosenstein, surgeon at Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco, L. H. Kampner, Mayor of Galveston, Texas. I. W. Hellman, President of the Union Trust Company in San Francisco, and many others. The petition begins, quote, "As a future form of government for Palestine will undoubtedly be considered by the approaching peace conference, we, the undersigned citizens of the United States, unite in this statement, setting forth our objections to the organization of a Jewish state in Palestine, as proposed by the Zionist societies in this country and Europe," unquote. The petitioners felt that they were, quote, "voicing the opinion of the majority of American Jews," unquote. To back that up, they pointed out, quote, "The American Zionists represent, according to the most recent statistics available, only a small proportion of the Jews living in this country, about 150,000 out of 3.5 million, unquote. As their source, they cited the 1918 edition of the American Jewish Yearbook in Philadelphia. The petition goes on to sound not only a protest, but a series of warnings. The signers did sympathize with the concept of, quote, "a refuge in Palestine or elsewhere," unquote. They felt that this would be a good thing, purely as a haven for Jews living under oppression. But they were bitterly opposed to the Zionist demands for, quote, "reorganization of the Jews as a national unit to whom now or in the future territorial sovereignty in Palestine shall be committed," unquote. The Jews who published that petition against the Zionist state 60 years ago turned out to be prophets. Like most prophets, their warnings went unheeded. But for more than three decades, events in the Middle East have been acting out their warnings in flesh, blood, and tragedy. I can do no more than highlight a few points from the anti-Zionist petition, which is long and detailed. But history demands that we be aware of the efforts of the anti-Zionist Jews to turn aside tragedy, deep tragedy. They pointed out that the Zionists were demanding, quote, "a home, not merely for Jews living in countries in which they are oppressed, but for Jews universally. No Jew, wherever he may live, can consider himself free from the implications of such a grant," unquote. From a practical standpoint, my friends, they pointed out that tiny Palestine could not hold all the Jews then living in the world. The 6 to 10 million in Russia and Romania alone would have produced hopeless overcrowding. But beyond that, they objected to what they termed political segregation. They felt it was both undemocratic and dangerous to Jews themselves the world over. They worried, quote, "all Jews repudiate every suspicion of a double allegiance, but to our minds it is necessarily implied in and cannot by any logic be eliminated from the establishment of a sovereign state for the Jews in Palestine," unquote. They added that, quote, "as a rule, those who favor such a restoration advocate it, not for themselves, but for others. Those who act thus and yet insist on their patriotic attachment to the countries of which they are citizens are self-deceived in their profession of Zionism," unquote. They were worried that Jews themselves would be torn internally by pressures for double allegiance. And they were concerned that this would play into the hands of those who consider Jews, quote, "aliens in every land, incapable of true patriotism, and prompted only by sinister and self-seeking motives," unquote. Quoting Sir George Adam Smith, an authority of that day on Palestine, they also foresaw the bloodshed to come. Quote, "It is not true that Palestine is the national home of the Jewish people and of no other people. It is not correct to call its non-Jewish inhabitants Arabs, or to say that they have left no image of their spirit and made no history except in the great mosque. Nor can we evade the fact that Christian communities have been as long in the possession of their portion of this land as ever the Jews were," unquote. The petition also says, quote, The claims to various sections of this undefined territory would unquestionably evoke bitter controversies. To subject the Jews to the possible recurrence of such bitter and sanguinary conflict, which would be inevitable, would be a crime. Unquote. Finally, they concluded with the words, "We do not wish to see Palestine, either now or at any time in the future, organized as a Jewish state." Unquote. But, my friends, the Zionists were successful in thwarting this appeal by prominent American Jews. Israel became a nation in 1947, and the predicted bloodshed began immediately. Israeli terrorism by Menachem Begin and others caused Palestinian blood to run red in the streets. Palestinians became refugees in their own land, and the borders of Israel began expanding. Soon, there was nothing left of what had been called Palestine. The Middle East war plan, which the Russians halted in May 1979, involved the Zionists in alliance with the Bolsheviks. The Russians are determined to end the threat of nuclear war. And after 30 years of Israeli history, they have concluded the same thing about Zionism as about Bolshevism. They are convinced that there will be no peace in the world for Jew, Muslim, or Christian so long as Zionism exists. So they are now in a two-front war to destroy both Zionism and Bolshevism. Long ago, Russia's new rulers discovered that Zionism and Bolshevism had common origins. These origins involve the Rothschilds, but others are involved also. So they are now following the trail of satanic power towards its origins, using their secret weapons, the robotoids. Right now, they are striking at the tentacles of world power, like Zionism and Bolshevism. But when the time is ripe, they are hoping to strike at the very head of world satanic power. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.